we're going to call the meeting's order. I know everybody's just on fine from the weekend, and I personally am glad that they're back. I think my kids have been spoiled for too long with these gray and brown winters with no snow. So I'm glad it's here, but I know people are coming in late, especially our greater Minnesota members, taking a while to get down. But we want to get started so we can use all the time we have. And members, we're going to start with the sales tax today. Remember, we finished the income tax. And so we're just going to get started with Ms. Dalton. I would again ask that members ask questions as we go. So, Ms. Dalton.
Thank you for the record. I'm Pat Dalton with House Research, and I'm going to start with the sales tax portion that's been in the news most, and that's the motor vehicle sales tax. As you all are aware, there was a constitutional dedication of motor vehicle sales tax revenues to transportation that passed at the general election. The amendment requires that no more than 60% of the tax go to roads and no less than 40% go to transit. And the dedication is phased in over 4 years. What this means is that in the dedication starts in fiscal year 2008, and it will be fully phased in by fiscal year 2012. Currently, 46.25% of the motor vehicle sales tax goes to the general fund. In fiscal year 2008, the dedication, which is currently 53%, will go to 63.75%, and then it goes up 10% a year for each of these subsequent years.
Excuse me, Ms. Dalton, can you tell members what page you're on? And members, you probably put this packet of information in your folder after the last meeting. If you don't have it, we'll see if we can't find you another copy. But Ms. Dalton, what page are you working on?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're on page 20 of the packet. But we're on, if you're looking at the handout, we are on page 11 of the overview of the PowerPoint presentation.
Thank you.
And we're about to start page 12. The graph here shows essentially how this is going to be phased in, assuming that the actual split that is enacted is the 60-40 split. This is a decision that is going to have to be determined by the legislature. The split can be different as long as it meets the minimum 40 and the maximum 60. The other decision that the legislature is going to have to make about the motor vehicle sales tax distribution, even after the constitutional dedication, is once you decide how much is going to transit and how much is going to transportation, you're also going to have to decide how much of the transit money goes to greater Minnesota cities, goes to greater Minnesota, and how much of it stays in the metropolitan area. Just to give you kind of a sense of where the money is now, in fiscal year 2007, 21% of the total motor vehicle sales tax revenues went to the Metro Transit, and 1.43% of the total revenues went to Greater Minnesota Transit. Again, this is a decision you'll have about how you're going to make that split. Of course, the dedication does leave a hole in the general fund revenue.
Excuse me, Ms. Dalton. Representative Sunson has a question, but before we do that, because we do have a quorum, I would officially call the meeting to order, but I would also ask members if you could take a minute and look at the minutes, and I take a motion to approve the minutes then.
So moved.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The motion is the minutes are adopted. Representative Sunson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ms. Dalton, would you see this being on the split? Would you see this being put in as a long term split? Are we going to look at this as every biennium to continually before we move forward on this, or how do you see this 46 split being?
Madam Chair, Representative Simpson, that is entirely up to you. I mean, the legislature has a history of playing around with the current dedication of motor vehicles sales tax prior to the constitutional dedication on an almost annual or at least a biennial basis. So because there is no absolute written into the constitutional dedication, I'm guessing you're going to see a lot of that continue to happen where it's negotiated every biennium.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe a question for you. Little preview. Do you anticipate or do you expect the 60-40 split or whatever it ends up being that bill traveling through your committee here? I mean, it would seem to make sense to me that we would have an opportunity to see that. It's related to the collection and distribution of taxes. Do you anticipate us having an opportunity to have a what I'm sure will be a very lively debate around that subject in this committee?
Thank you, Representative Coles. I do, and I appreciate bipartisanly that members fight for the purview of this committee. It is important that this committee retain that ability to look over questions like you just raised, Representative Coles, and I wouldn't want to change the way it's been conducted in the last 8 years. Yes, the transportation, any changes to the transportation taxes have historically come here, whether they're wheelage or this split or the gas tax or any other sort of method, local metro-wide sales tax, and I absolutely would fight that would come to this committee. I would anticipate that we'll see members who will have bills bipartisanly to clarify that language, but I also think we'll expect members to have bills to clarify the issue of the greater Minnesota split, and I think we need to have that discussion that Ms. Dalton has raised on what has happened historically, how much has been metro, and how much has been greater. Beyond that, once you get to greater, with whatever percentage it is, how do you divvy up greater between regional centers and other areas? And so I hope our greater Minnesota members, bipartisanly, will be working to bring an alternative to this committee. Thank you. Other questions before we move on? Not Ms. Dalton.
Basically, what this slide is showing you is the impact on the general fund from this motor vehicle sales tax dedication, and it's expected to be $285 million whole by fiscal year 2012. However, one thing to keep in mind is that currently there are funds appropriated out of the general fund for both transportation and transit. And the estimate for the current biennium is there's about $225 million coming out of the general fund for those purposes. About $6 million of that is money that is actually to fund agencies, you know, the employees at MnDOT and public safety and things like that. That cannot be funded out of either the Highway User Trust Fund or the Transit Fund. So that would clearly have to remain. But then there is also the question of how much does the legislature want to continue to fund transportation and transit out of the general fund given this dedication? One other note, which I don't even have a slide for before we go to the general sales taxes, and that is that there is one other dedicated portion of the sales taxes, and that is the tax in lieu of sales tax on the lottery tickets. That tax raises about $20 million a year, and 72.5% of it is currently dedicated to natural resources, trails, and zoos. So now we'll go through the general sales tax. General sales tax rate, 6.5%. There are two special rates, rental motor vehicles. Short-term rental motor vehicles pay at a rate of 12.7%. Some of that money is dedicated, some of it is not. And then manufactured housing and park trailers, they pay the 6.5% rate, but they only pay it on 65% of the cost. We used to have a third special rate, which was a 9% rate on liquor taxes. Liquor is now subject to 6.5% sales tax, and there is a different gross receipts tax on liquor, which we will talk about near the end when we talk about streamlined sales tax. The rate for Minnesota has not changed since 1991. It is one of the higher state rates in the country. There are only seven states who have a 6.5% or higher. Only three are higher than 6.5% for a state rate: Mississippi, Rhode Island, and Tennessee. However, a number of states have higher combined state and local rates. Our highest state and local combined rate is 7.5%. 17 states have higher combined state-local rates than that. Representative Carson.
When I was on the tax committee years ago, we would always talk about the effective rate. And what would that be for my state? I mean, that's, in my view, a better comparison between states. If you don't know that now, but we used to have that discussion because the rate is one question and the effective rate is quite a different question because of the large number of exemptions in the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that is a really good question. I don't know the answer, but you are correct. The effective rate at different income levels can vary dramatically because of the fact that some states have a very narrow base and some states have an incredibly broad base. Minnesota does have one of the narrower bases because we exempt food and clothing and heating fuels and other things like that. So,
Ms. Dalton. I do believe when we get the new incidents report, Representative Carlson will actually have that information in there. Maybe Mr. Michael's looking at the last one. But if we can't get that information today, I think when we do have the incidents report brought to us by the Department of Revenue, we could take a minute to actually read that page of the report so members can understand the point that Representative Carlson is making, because the effective tax rate really does fall marginally differently on different groups of people. Ms. Dalton, did you want to add to that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this was a slide we had done earlier. We had shown earlier. This is based on the most recent incident study and shows effective rates. What that can't tell you, however, is what is the effective rate in other states. So, if you're trying to do a comparison, us versus other states, we don't really have any good information on that. But this is the effective rate in terms of consumer purchases.
And that's the reason I raised the question when you referenced the three other states that had a higher rate. That's on the table then what the effective rate is, because it's more, at least in my view, a more valid comparison. I'll wait until that happens.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Riccovina.
Well, Madam Chair, and I was going to bring it up too. Thanks, Representative Carlson, for bringing it up. But, you know, I recall sitting on tax committee for years that talking about the progressivity of Minnesota sales tax because food and clothing is exempt. Now, when you make a statement like Ms. Dalton just made, that we're third highest in the nation or whatever, when you take into account the other factors, we may be one of the lower or sitting in the middle somewhere. I don't think our tax incident study would reflect that in comparison to other states. And we should really know that because, you know, I don't want to have the governor or Representative LaForest or whatever harping about our high sales tax rate when, in fact, it might be one of the lowest in the country.
Representative Riccovina, Ms. Dalton, maybe you could take a shot at trying to get that information to us. But I do think, in fairness to Ms. Dalton, she said 17 other states are higher when you combine state and local. But I think the point Representative Riccovina and Representative Carlson are making is absolutely right. You know, those other states, many, as Representative Marquardt knows, some don't equalize at all within their property tax system. So to look at one tax system by itself and then try to guess what the burden might be on people, you know, I think it might make people wrongly think that relatively our sales tax is higher. And you're right, when you take things that are regressive out of the system and you add in progressive things, you can make the sales tax work better. And so if there's any way that you can provide for all of us an attempt to reflect all those things going on in the system together to see really where we are compared to other states. I know it's not apples and oranges. You've already heard a couple members who are interested in that information. I think it's best if we all just get it. Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there is some academic literature that has been done looking at this, and we'll take a look at that and see if there's some information that could be useful to the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, thanks. Change with the sales tax. But the effective rate we used to talk about was more like 4%. Was what, you know, if we were to compare with other states, you know, for example, if Minnesota was like a North Carolina that has a sales tax on everything, you know, they would be at a higher percentage. But with the comparison I'm talking about is in theory we were to tax everything, then if it raised the same amount of revenue, was like at 4%, we had a few years ago. what the point I was trying to make as well, and Representative Levine picked up on it, is we by design made ours more progressive. But we can wait on that discussion.
And
Madam Chair, just to, not to belabor this, but, you know, members, as we think of ways to possibly raise money, especially if we get an honest handle on, you know, the inflation that isn't built into our revenue forecast anymore, but, you know, if we're looking at ways to do it, I hope we would, if you go back to page 11 and look at the effective sales tax rates on population, food is definitely a necessity, and I'd say even you people in the cities will understand today on a cold day that clothing is pretty much a necessity in Minnesota too. We know that where we come from, but you know, if you shift onto food and clothing, think about the effects on that first quintile, the second quintile even, because most of what they're buying is food and clothing.
Ms. Dalton, did you want to respond? I remember that Representative Norman had a bill, I believe, to add clothing into the sales tax. And I remember looking at the incidents at that time, and I think one of the things I was interested in was finding out that adding clothing, I think, actually made the overall sales tax system more progressive, because the wealthier are, you buy it in larger amounts. And then there was some discussion as to how would you hold that first decile to harmless. If you were trying to add that in, would you give them a credit? Would you exempt purchases up to $50 or something like that? But I think on the food, it's definitely the case. And Ms. Dalton, I think it is worth committee time to talk about this a little bit, because for all of us who went to the Humphrey Institute and listened to Dr. Stinson and looked at those graphs about what's happening in the income tax in the long run and the sales tax base eroding, we have long-term problems, and we have to find solutions as to how we're going to have a tax system that's going to work to provide the revenue we need. Ms. Dalton, can you respond to Representative Rukavina?
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, Representative Lencheski is correct. The sales tax on clothing is less regressive. It is not progressive, but it is less regressive than the current local, the current sales tax base. So actually taxing it would make the overall tax less regressive than it currently is. It will still be a regressive tax. The Department of Revenue has actually, in recent years, done some work looking at some base expansions and whether it would add to the progressivity or regressivity, but I don't have any of those studies.
Madam Chair, I know I'm not the brightest bulb on the tree, but you know, Glenn Taylor could buy all the Armani suits and Gucci shoes that he could find in the country. And if you look at that top 1% down there, it's not nowhere going to equal as a percent of his income when Representative Saitel goes to the store and buys those old Converse high-top gym shoes because that's all he can afford. You know, I can't understand. It kind of reminds me of what old Representative Walt Perth used to say, that figures don't lie, but liars figure. So I don't know who came up with those numbers, but I can't understand it.
Ms. Dalton, and Representative Simpson has a question, too. Do you have in your presentation, and, you know, I don't know what you've got in the pages coming up, do you have a further discussion on this issue of what goes in and out of the sales tax to make it progressive and regressive? I know the members, like Representative Rukavina, who's been on the committee for a while, understand Governor Ventura took a shot at this. That time we spent a lot of time looking at bringing in some of the professional services within the Minnesota economy and just services in general and kind of discuss it. Is this in your presentation today? Are you going to try to break it down at all, or is that a future meeting?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we talk a little bit about possible base expansions, but no, we don't go into the whole incidence of those base expansions. We could certainly do that in a future meeting if you were interested in doing it. I think the one thing that needs to be kept in mind is absent credits or exemptions for low income, it would be virtually impossible to design a sales tax system that was progressive because of the mere fact that you tend to spend more of your income at lower levels, period, just to live, whereas if you are at a higher level, you spend a smaller portion of your income on anything and you save a greater portion of your income. So there's, frankly, no way, absent income tax credits or some exemptions, that you could design a property tax, a sales tax system that was I mean, unless you literally only tax luxury goods. And then you would have an incredibly narrow base.
Thank you, Representative Simpson. I think Ms. Dalton, before your question, just proved the point that members have been on this committee already know that whenever Representative Rukavina says he's not the brightest bulb on the tree, we know that's not true. Ms. Dalton having just confirmed his concern. So don't fall for that, members, if you're new to the committee. Representative Rukavina knows exactly. He knows the tax system very well.
Madam Chair,
the difference between having street smarts because you're little and being smart, I just want to clear that right now. You know, you're smart. I got street smarts.
I just have a comment, with the surplus that we have, I was kind of would like to hear a little more discussion about eliminating that temporary sales tax that we put on at 0.5%. Was it 1991, I believe, or something? So I think we need to have that discussion also as we move forward.
Ms. Dalton, Representative Simpson raises a good point. I know there's a few members who were here then, not very many, but maybe a little history, just anecdotally, and how the sale, when the sales came about, I think it was the Levander Penny, or some members know, but a little history as to how that was called a temporary increase in the sales tax and why it's still here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, on page 22 of the longer handout, there is actually a rate chart. The increase in 1991 of 0.5 cent wasn't known as a temporary, it was known as an optional. And it was originally enacted as an optional local sales tax, optional in quotation marks, because any county that did not enact this 0.5 cent local sales tax, the county and any of the local governments within that county couldn't receive aid from the state. So there was a really, really big stick attached to that one.
Point of word, optional.
I think that that's quite amusing that the word optional is used under that pretense, but I guess I would like to, as we move forward, continue to, if we're going to look at this sales tax thing, I think that that part of it also has to be examined. So,
thank you,
Representative Rukavina.
Excuse me. Thank you, Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I'm just, Ms. Dalton, wondering about regressivity, and you know, we often or have been talking quite a bit about the gas tax, and I'm wondering if you have any sense of where that falls on the regressivity chart in regards to taxes.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, I don't know right offhand. Joel has the old incident study, and he can take a look. But in the meantime, maybe we should move on. Representative, Mr. Michael. I think he's going to find the answer to Representative Brown's question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the gas tax, the motor fuels excise tax under the 2005 incident study is not quite twice as regressive as, it's maybe like 75% more regressive than the basic sales tax base.
Madam Chair, going on a brief discussion of the sales tax base. Generally, goods, personal property, are taxable unless specifically exempted in our state, and services are usually not taxable unless they are specifically included. Having said that, we have a lot of taxes that we do, a lot of services that we do tax. On the goods side, the major exemptions for individuals consist of the ones that we are most familiar with, food for home consumption, clothing, home heating fuels, motor fuel subject to the gas tax. You pay one or the other, you don't pay both. Prescription drugs and all drugs. I did not update this slide. Since 2006, all drugs are now exempt. Newspapers and subscription magazines and cigarettes. Now, cigarettes, there's a little asterisk next to. We still tax
cigarettes, except we no longer tax them at the retail level. They're exempt from the 6.5% sales tax, but now an equivalent tax is put on them at the wholesale level, and the actual per pack rate is calculated every year based on an average price of a pack of cigarettes, and then that amount is calculated, and then that tax is paid at the wholesale level now instead of at the retail level.
Representative Fulmer.
When we put in the health impact fee and raised the price of a pack of cigarettes of 75 cents, did they recalculate then that the additional tax, did it get applied to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, yes. Those two changes were made in the same legislative session, and the initial estimate of the average retail price was adjusted to reflect the health impact fee impact, and so it did include that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's good staff work, Madam Chair. You don't even have to know where we are. You just don't listen. Ms. Dalton, Mr. Michael, I'm specifically interested in services not usually taxed, services and or labor. I've come across some issues from constituents that are very confusing. Sometimes you tax labor, sometimes you don't. I think we can easily make crooks out of a lot of honest people with the way this thing is. Can you give me any kind of idea on a direction that we've gone as to when we tax labor, when we don't tax labor, or has it been simply a question of we get an exemption here just because?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, back, and I want to say 2001 or 2002, we redefined what is included in sales price. And we needed to do this to get into compliance with the Streamlined Sales Tax Agreement. However, we had some choices, and some of the choices we made were not required choices. One of the choices that was made at that time...
I apologize. I'm going to stop you just because I know that a third of the committee members have never been on the tax committee. And I want you to just, I know it's further ahead, but just explain the Streamlined Sales Tax Project so people are understanding what we adopted and what that is. I think we just to appropriately answer Representative Jemmer, I think we need to understand the context of this item.
We were going to get to it, so we'll just jump to it right now. Streamlined Sales Tax Agreement, otherwise known as the SSTA, used to be known as the SSTP, but we always change acronyms. It's an agreement to simplify and streamline tax administration and collection between states. Right now, states are not allowed to require remote sellers, people selling over the Internet or people catalog sellers, to collect their tax unless those people have a physical presence in the state. It's called Nexus. The last court case basically said, well, this imposes an undue burden. The reason you can't do it is it imposes an undue burden on interstate commerce. And so this is actually an attempt to reduce the burden, the undue burden on interstate commerce, and either get Congress to say, yes, these remote sellers have a duty to collect all these state taxes, or conversely, to eventually go back to the Supreme Court and say, and get them to say, well, now that you've streamlined, there isn't an undue burden, and yes, these people can be required to collect. Basically, it includes standard rules about rates, sourcing, registration, and the big thing is how you define things, goods and services, how you define sales price, things like that. They've all been standardized. We are one of, I think it's either 15 or 17. I've got to go up and take a look. We are one of 15 states that are currently in compliance with the agreement and are a voting member of the agreement. So, and we did most of our compliance legislation in 2001 and 2002. We were one of the first states to start enacting compliance legislation. As part of that, we did say that installation labor is taxable. And so that has really caused some confusion about when is something installation labor and when is it labor that can be stated separately and sales tax not apply to it.
Representative Downer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, if I understand right, sometimes installation labor is taxable if it's new, but if it's installing something that is used, it is not taxable. Is that true?
Madam Chair, actually, Representative Downer, this gets to the, we tax installation labor, but we do not tax repair labor. And so, for instance, using an easy example, you have a radio in your car and the radio goes on the fritz and you take it into the dealer and you have it replaced with the exact same radio. That's a repair. And so the installation in that case is not subject to tax. On the other hand, if you say, well, my radio's on the fritz, but, you know, as long as I'm going to replace it, I'm going to get a really nice CD system.
And new speakers, of course.
And new speakers and all of that. That is actually an upgrade. That is not a repair. That is a replacement. And under those circumstances, the labor would be taxed because that would be taxable installation labor.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah. With this definition, Madam Chair, what's the status of carpet installation? Could you do for me, because you and I had a conversation at one point about lawn service.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, carpet installation would not be subject to tax because that would be an improvement to real property, and anything that becomes a permanent part of real property is not subject to tax. The contractor who's doing the installation would pay sales tax on the carpet when he purchased, and then his entire bill to you would not be subject to tax because it's an improvement to real property.
Yeah, lawn care. I won't ask you to review that if you don't remember, but we did have that's another complex area, if I recall, in terms of when things are taxed and when they're not, and for the industry it gets quite confusing, but if you don't go off the top of your head, I just point that out as another confusing area of when things are taxed and when they're not.
Representative Carlson, thank you for that. Ms. Dalton, I won't ask you to look up lawn service right now, but Ms. Dalton knows all the answers to all of these questions, and maybe it would just be helpful before we go to Representative Mullery, could you just tell us, just for the committee's understanding, when we made the decision to join SSTP, or SSTA, it's called now, how many decisions like this had to be made within the tax, the sales tax system? Because often I think the public thinks it's just one tax, it's 6.5%, that's it. And it's literally hundreds of decisions, if not thousands, on all of the minutiae of these areas. Just in general, what's the kind of, how many different taxes were taking place before, and how many decisions had to be made by Minnesota to join this coalition?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we were actually one of the lucky states. We actually have a fairly simple sales tax system compared to most states. I know when you look at it, we've got like 120 exemptions from our sales tax base written into statute right now. But we are truly one of the simpler states, mainly because we generally do not allow local sales taxes. Everybody has to have the same sales tax base. We've had a lot of what was adopted for administrative purposes, we actually already did that. For instance, local governments weren't allowed to collect their local taxes and things like that. So compared to a number of states, we were actually fairly easy to comply with. Having said that, we actually wrote quite a bit of language, and being one of the first states to get into compliance, we also found some of the problems for those who were around in 2001 and heard about the bread tax or the meat tax, where we were taxing bread sold in bakeries but not bread sold in grocery stores. There were some glitches in this process. One of the things that did help is that the Department of Revenue from this state has been highly active in the group that actually wrote the streamlined sales tax agreement, and they continue to be very active in that group. One of the employees from the Department of Revenue is actually the chair of the group that interprets the definitions that have been developed. So they,
So we actually still have quite a bit of hand in it, which is good because it helps make sure that things get interpreted in ways that we don't have to mess around with. But we have had to create like a fur tax, which we can get rid of this year, which I'll talk about. We've had to create a separate alcohol tax to deal with the fact that we used to have a 9% alcohol tax. And we have had to play around, or we had to modify some of our definitions on the margin, medical equipment and prescription drugs being the most recent.
Representative Mueller, and then we'll go to Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to get into all the different definitions. What I did have a question was, I remember that, I think it's like, is it 40% of the population of the country has to be in states that have adopted it, and certain percentage of the states, I can't remember those two, but have enough states adopted it, and do they represent the necessary population percent of the country that we can put it in force, and if so, when are we going to get it going?
Madam Chair, Representative Mueller, for the agreement to take effect, it was, I believe, 10 states representing at least 20% of the total population in the country, and we have exceeded that. We also have 7 more states that will be in compliance on January 1, 2008. So over half of the states in the country will be in compliance with the agreement and will be part of the agreement. The problem with the agreement, of course, is at this point it is a voluntary agreement. If your state, you know, if you voluntarily register in any of the states under the agreement, you are registered in all of the states under the agreement to collect the tax. But there still is not a duty to for remote sellers to collect the tax, and that is going to require congressional action, or it is going to require court action. So the agreement is in effect and is going on. The state has not realized as much voluntary revenue as they thought they would realize from being in the agreement, but the agreement is in effect.
Start, Madam Chair, just a follow-up. Then, so we can't just say now we've met this and all of the states that are part of the compact can just start assessing it, and then if somebody challenges, defend in court, they have to wait and actually take a prospective court case against... I can't remember. Is it the Quill case or whatever, or some follow-up to that? Do we have to sue them again?
Mr. Michael, and if you could define for, again, the third of the committee that's new, the Quill case. I think that's important.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what Ms. Dalton was and Representative Mulry were referring to is there were two U.S. Supreme Court cases. The first one was called National Bellis Hess in the 1960s and 67, and then subsequently the Quill case in 1992, I believe. And basically, in these cases, the U.S. Supreme Court held that a state could not require a seller that did not have physical presence in that state. By physical presence, that means an employee or a facility to require the tax on sales into the state. The facts in National Bellis Hess were that Missouri was trying to get a retailer located in Illinois that was shipping, or vice versa, I can't remember, shipping goods into the other state on catalog sales. Quill was a pure mail order sales case, where Quill was an office products company, I think since been acquired by Office Depot or Staples, one of the big that sort of sells office products nationally through catalogs and on online sites. But to get to Representative Mulry, so essentially the primary rationale for the courts deciding that was that the burden on these out-of-state sellers was simply too great to require them to collect the tax. And so, obviously, the states, through the Streamlined Sales Tax Project Act, are trying to address that by making the taxes simpler and easier to calculate, and by providing software online that can sort of automatically calculate what the tax would be just to reduce that burden. But to get to Representative Mullery's point, the Quill case is, the rule in the Quill case is still in effect, and so the states assume, yes, we could audit and try to demand that one of these out-of-state sellers pay, but until there's some sufficient change that we think that the ruling in the Quill case is likely to change, it probably doesn't make sense to try to compel these remote sellers to pay because the taxpayer will win. I think the Quill case, the court's opinion in the Quill case is pretty clear that they realize that the rule is sort of outmoded, but they're also recognize that existing remote sellers relied on it and that they sort of feel compelled to protect that reliance interest. And the court was pretty explicit about saying, look, it's up to Congress that has power under the Commerce Clause to deal with this and not the court, because, you know, we've ruled in the past and we don't want to overrule that and then impose penalties and all sorts of other obligations on remote sellers. So I think the prospects for actually overruling Quill, which is really what it would take for SSTP or SSTA on its own to result in a payment obligation by remote sellers, is not very good. And that's why everybody characterizes it now as a voluntary agreement. Now, there are ways that these remote sellers can subject themselves to Nexus, and they are at risk. And, for example, if they hire an agent in the state to do work for them, or if they happen to send a few employees in to do some work for customers, there's a point at which they've got enough contact with the state that then they may be subject to the tax, and so there's a risk. And that's why, for these great big corporations like Walmart and Target and so forth, voluntarily registering and complying sort of provides protection for them under the agreement, and so that's why there is some revenue from sort of the voluntary compliance. But essentially, that's a long answer to a complicated question.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. And thank you, Representative Mullery, for bringing that up. We have Representative Earhart and then Representative Zellers. Did you have something to add, Ms. Dalton, before we go to Representative Earhart?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the one thing I would add is that there has been bills introduced in Congress to require the duty to collect. None of them have passed yet, but all of them have essentially required that the duty to collect only will apply in the states that are in compliance with this agreement. So if there is federal legislation, we're going to need to be in compliance with this agreement to take advantage of that federal legislation.
Thank you. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got a couple of calls from last week, about one about a chimney repair job and one about a new carpet. When the purveyors of the product said, well, the tax will be so much, plus the new tax that was laid on the first of the year. At first I had to stop and think about that. Then I remembered that we are paid for a stadium in Hennepin County. Now, I want to know if there's any way that that would disturb our relationship with the rest of the members of the Streamlined Sales and Tax Agreement. Is there any way that we can back out of this agreement to tax the Hennepin County folks because it would disrupt our...
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, no, the Hennepin County tax was crafted in a way that it was in compliance with the Streamlined Sales Tax Agreement.
Thank you, Representative Earhart, and now... Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Ms. Dalton or Mr. Michael. Going back to Representative Earhart was talking about the repair versus replacement. I got a dishwasher went on the fritz, and we had to get a new one. The guy that brought it out wasn't a Sears employee, even though we bought it from Sears. He was a subcontractor. Now, I can imagine where the parent, the seller, parent company seller, has a responsibility to make sure that subcontractor either collects what's the occasion, say that I have it delivered, and guy walks around my neighborhood, puts things in everybody's mailboxes, I do repairs, I do household stuff. Now, that person isn't nearly as involved or has many tax lawyers as, say, Sears does, but he doesn't know how to install my dishwasher, puts it in for me, doesn't collect the tax because this is a new dishwasher I've improved, it's not a replacement. When we're talking about this, these scoff laws, the tax scoff laws that are cheating the system, are some of these independent contractors not aware of this in-depth and layers of tax policy, some of the folks that could be considered non-compliant, or, I mean, we all think there are folks hiding their money in the Cayman Islands, but could some of these small independent contractors that don't have the knowledge of this be the ones that aren't collecting the tax that they probably should?
Ms. Dalton?
Madam Chair, Representative Zeller, this gets into some of the gray areas. However, for instance, if you purchased a new dishwasher and installed it yourself, you would pay sales tax on the dishwasher and you would not pay sales tax on the installation labor. If you were a business and you purchased it yourself and had one of your employees install it, there was clearly no sales tax. If you purchase it separately and then you pay somebody else to install it, it is not part of the sales price because it was not included in the original purchase, and so it also would not be subject to the sales tax. There are a couple of instances where that's not quite true, but generally speaking.
Representative Sellers.
No, that's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Demmer is next. I do want to mention on that, we are going to hear from the legislative auditor next week, and we're going to hear the tax compliance report that came out, I think it was in March, and that is pertinent there, too. We should talk a little bit about that. Before we go to Representative Demmer, I just want to tell members that tomorrow we will have committee at 10. We will adjourn at 11 so that everyone can get over for State of the State. So I wanted to announce that while we're all here. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I won't bring up another example. I think we'd be here for the next 3 weeks if we were doing examples. But, again, just to make clear, back to my original question, is it compliance with this this uniform tax and the definition of the labor when it's new installed, when it's not new installed, when it's repair? Is that where that came from? In other words, do we have to have this sort of a definition of services, sometimes not, sometimes included, in order to be in compliance?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, we don't. That is actually one of the options, and we could have chosen to exempt all installation labor, and then we wouldn't have this line drawing that we currently have.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. I sense a bill from a member.
Madam Chair, if I could. You know, I think the what do you call that?
SSTA.
Do I have to know what that means to just use it?
No. Green line sales tax.
Okay. Actually, I think it makes sense in terms of business in the state of Minnesota. It's really in this nationally and even international world of business now, we do hold our, I think states, businesses in our state are at a disadvantage when they have to charge sales tax and their competitors do not. So I think the streamlined sales tax is a good idea. But on the other side of the coin, these same businesses, I think, are really struggling and, quite frankly, living in fear of our own Department of Revenue. Unless they just sales tax everything they ever do, there can't be too many out there that feel like they're safe in terms of an audit and knowing whether they did it the right way or not. And I think just some of the brief examples here today are an example of that. So, Madam Chair, there might be something coming.
Thank you, Representative Demmer. Members, may I encourage you, if you have bills that you're thinking about to either expand the sales tax and add either services or products in the sales tax or exempt something that's currently taxed, I would encourage you to get those bills in. And the reason is it's going to take revenue a little while to get those estimates to the committee, and so members always like to know what number that costs. How much does the state lose then if, for example, the issue that was just raised, you had a bill like that and we passed it, what would it cost? So I think it's helpful for the full committee to start getting those bills in if you're interested in that. I've heard a lot of discussion on in that area bipartisanly, both putting things on the sales tax and taking them off. And the sooner those things can get dropped into the hopper, I think it's helpful for all of us. Ms. Dalton, I think we've gotten a little behind.
Well, actually, we've done a lot of the presentation, so I'll just cover the little
part. Okay, thank you, Ms. Dalton.
We were talking about exemptions initially. One of the areas where we have a number of exemptions are in business and farm. 44% of the sales tax is paid by business, often on inputs. And when you are taxing business inputs, you essentially, this leads to tax pyramiding. That tax gets built into the final price, and so people are effectively paying a higher tax than 6.5%. So over the years, there's been a movement to exempt inputs. Page 25 of the large handout actually shows business inputs that have been exempted over the years. Capital equipment is the big one, although that is not an upfront exemption, which you will probably hear about. People must pay the sales tax on capital equipment and then apply for a refund. Farm machinery, certain direct inputs to agricultural and industrial production are exempt, and certain direct inputs for some taxable services. You might hear people refer to the 1987 services. There were a number of services like building cleaning and lawn maintenance and things like that that were subject to tax in 1987 as part of dealing with a budget shortfall. And most recently, I believe that was in 1997, we exempted the inputs into the provision of those taxable services from sales tax. Other major sales tax exemptions are sales to schools, the federal government, public libraries, and hospitals. We do, however, tax most local government purchases. The other exemptions tend to be in the area of public safety, fire equipment, emergency firefighting gear, protective body armor for police. Some of those things are selectively exempted. Sales to nonprofit charitable organizations are exempt, and certain sales by nonprofit charitable organizations are exempt. We talked about sales tax and remote sales and the streamlined sales tax. As I said, Minnesota is one of 15 states in compliance. I'm sorry, I missed something. One thing that we probably do want to point out is that the Department of Revenue did an estimate a couple of years ago about how much money the state was losing because it could not collect sales tax on remote sales, and the estimate for fiscal year 2005 was $250 million a year. So it's not insignificant.
Madam Chair.
Representative Holbert.
In the last forecast, mm-hmm. 2 years ago or a year ago when we had the budget, there was a estimate of how much the voluntary would take in. And we haven't met that goal. Do you remember what those numbers were?
Representative Solbert, Ms. Dalton.
Because it's a sizable amount that did not come in.
It is a large amount. And important for the tax committee to understand that. And following up with Representative Solbert, if I may, I'm trying to understand this myself, is the problem where we're not receiving the money from the SSTP compliance initiative that we thought we would, is that built into the last forecast? Was it already in, and it will be going forward, so the numbers are including that? Yes, I see not. Okay, Representative Solberg's question. Ms. Templin.
Representative Solberg, Madam Chair. In 2005, the legislature, the omnibus bill for taxes included 56.8 in additional revenues as a result of SSTA, and that was in the fiscal 08-09 biennium, or 06-07 biennium, excuse me, and additional revenues in fiscal 08-09, and I don't have those right now. And the forecast has been adjusted accordingly down, and I do not have those numbers with me right now, but I can send that information to you.
I'm sure I think it was in the area of about 34.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, from memory, $36 million in the 06-07 biennium was the amount the forecast was reduced from additional sales tax revenues from SSTA, and I believe it was $96 million in the fiscal 08-09 biennium is the amount the forecast was reduced.
Thank you, Ms. Templin.
I bring that up because that's a sizable percentage, mm-hmm. not necessarily a sizable a dollar amount in the total budget, but it is a sizable percentage. $20 million in 1 year is a sizable amount.
It is. Thank you, Representative Solberg. And Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dalton, I recall we still tax ourselves, don't we, on this? And is there any if we're doing that, is there any estimate on how much money we lose in bureaucracy on ship doing that?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, yes, we have tax state purchases since, I believe, 1987. And again, it was a budget shortfall, and it was a way of actually reducing all state agency budgets without going through and chopping every one of them by a little bit. Representative Mullery, I don't know what the dead weight loss is of taking money out of this pocket and putting it into the other pocket. I believe it's been reduced in recent years because we've gone to direct pay. So essentially the agencies just don't, they don't pay it every time. They just pay it once a year. They don't pay it on each individual purchase. They're a direct pay permittee, so they essentially just make one payment to the state. So I think the loss is fairly minimal.
Thank you.
The one thing that I did want to also point out about the streamlined sales tax, to get into compliance with it, you are required to have only one rate per state, and you have to meet the definitions. The very first problem we ran into is we had an exemption for clothing except for clothing made out of fur. We had, you know, if you bought a fur coat, it was subject to tax. And people were very uncomfortable about suddenly exempting fur clothing when we were coming into compliance, and so Minnesota actually created a gross receipts tax on fur clothing, and then when we reduced the tax on alcoholic beverages from 9% to 6.5%, we imposed a 2.5 cent gross receipts tax on at the wholesale level on alcoholic beverages. I am happy to announce that there have been some changes to SSTA in December. They have now come up with the definition of fur clothing. So this state could actually eliminate its gross receipts tax on fur clothing, and we could go back to subjecting fur clothing to the regular sales tax, and I believe the Department of Revenue is going to be recommending that in their policy bill. Final thing, and I really didn't think I was going to take this much time, local sales taxes. As of right now, there are 21 cities and 2 counties in the state who are allowed to impose a general local sales tax. This is an amazing increase in the last few years. Prior to 2005, there were 13. So this is a big jump. Duluth and Cook County have a 1% rate. Hennepin County has the 0.15%. All others have a 0.5 cent rate. All of the local government taxes have an expiration provision except for the city of Duluth. Duluth is always the oddball. and I may be done unless people have other questions.
Other questions for Ms. Dalton on the sales tax? If not, thank you, Ms. Dalton. I'm sure you'll get a lot more from many of us as the session wears on, and I believe Mr. Michael is going to cover the corporate tax now. Mr. Michael.
And fair members of the committee, I'll go through the rest of the state taxes, and then I'm guessing that that likely will take the rest of the time today. And then the next time we do an orientation, we'll do the property tax, which will be next week, I believe. Corporate franchise tax, often referred to or thought of as the corporate income tax. It's called a franchise tax for federal purposes so that the state is allowed to tax the interest on U.S. government obligations. So that's really just a nominal thing. The tax base is basically the profits of C corporations. So it does not apply to businesses that are operating as partnerships, LLCs, so forth, or as S corporations, which is a separate subchapter of the Internal Revenue Code that allows most of the income and tax attributes to pass through to the shareholders. Obviously, the state has the authority only to tax income that's attributable or profits that are attributable to Minnesota, and most of these businesses operate in many states. So the challenge that all states face is how to apportion or attribute that those national or international, multinational profits to their state. All the states use some variation of apportionment formulas to do this. The tradition always, the tradition when I started was an arithmetic three-factor formula. In other words, how much is your in-state property, payroll, and sales to your total property, payroll, and sales? Minnesota was one of the first states to go to a weighted formula. It did that as an option back in the 1930s for industrial corporations. In the 1980s, it became the only apportionment option. Right now, we're at, as you can see on the slide, 78% sales and 11% each for property and payroll. Under legislation enacted in 2005, we're going to single sales apportionment, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. The tax, Minnesota tax rate is 9.8%. Compared to other states, that's one of the higher tax rates, but we also have a narrower base. So it's, on average, where our corporate taxes hangs around the top 10 or so. The corporate tax has a number of credits that are allowed. The most important of these is the research and development credit, which provides a tiered percentage credit for corporate based on the amount of increasing research in the state. There's also a credit that applies in very limited situations for taxes paid to other states. And then there's also a credit under both the Job Z program and the old Enterprise Zone credit for businesses that operate in those zones. I said earlier that the tax mainly applies to C-type corporations, but there's also a minimum fee that applies to all businesses, including partnerships, sole proprietorships, and S corporations. This fee is based on the amount of property, payroll, and sales in Minnesota. And the minimum amount of the fee, which only applies to businesses that have at least a half a million of those items, is for those that have over a half a million, it starts at $100, and the highest minimum fee is $5,000. And this is not an alternative minimum fee. This is an add-on minimum fee. Important to talk about the revenues a little bit. The estimate for fiscal year 2007 is that the tax will raise $1.1 billion. This obviously pales by comparison to the three major taxes, the income tax, the sales tax, and the property tax, which raise four or five times or more than that. But one important thing to point out, which is the second bullet on this slide, is that the revenues from the corporate tax are the most volatile of all of our revenue sources. I should have put a slide together on this. I just didn't think of it until too late. But just to illustrate how volatile the revenues from this tax are, during the recession in the early 80s and the most recent recession that we went through, the revenues from this tax dropped in nominal amount by a third, by 33%. So, for example, in 2000, we collected $800 million in corporate tax revenues. In 2002, those revenue flows had dropped about $530 million. That's a huge drop. But now, probably even more remarkably, 2 years later, they've gone up almost by 50%. And now for fiscal 07, compared to the trough in 2002, they're projected to go up by 100%. This is really astonishing variation in the amount of tax revenues from one tax, which is a fairly major source of revenue.
Mr. Michael, if I may stop you. Members, I'll take this opportunity right now to tell you that, having read the rules we're operating under right now, to form a subcommittee in the Minnesota House, a chair can decide to do that with consultation with the Speaker. And I have not had that meeting yet, but I have worked with our staff, and a concern I have, and I know that I've spoken to some of you already, is this issue of the volatility of the corporate tax. This is a very serious problem for Minnesota, and I know that some of you are interested in this issue, and others, you know, could just fall asleep as you think about it. But I do intend, and I am just not 100% sure, but I wanted to bring it up now, to form a subcommittee, this Committee on Business Taxation, and so that any member here who would be interested on, about this set of issues, I hope you will let me know, because I think this is something that maybe we can't get it done this year. If you follow the forecast and represent Solberg and Carlson, I'm sure very aware, this is a big problem for all of us in planning and in surplus deficit swings, what's happening with the Minnesota corporate tax, whether it's the Hutchinson Tech case or some of the issues that represent, or that Mr. Michael's already raised. So if you have an interest in business taxation, please let me know, and I hope to know soon if we can form that subcommittee, and then we would not have the tax committee meet during some of those times so that that subcommittee then could work on this issue. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just following on that, I guess maybe Mr. Michael was already going to cover this, but I just wanted to ask, just in really simple terms for those of us who are new to this, what is it that makes this so volatile? I mean, if this is not based on income, or is it just, I thought it was based on property, payroll, and sales, or maybe I'm misunderstanding.
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, the volatility of the tax, to step back a second, the tax base is basically corporate income or profits. And, of course, corporate profits vary a lot across the business cycle. They can, you know, drop or rise, and to the point where during periods where they drop, they can actually go negative overall. And so part of the volatility, a big part of the volatility, is just the underlying volatility of the tax base. Now, the complication is, you know, some of the tax rules that Minnesota has make that even more a consideration. And that it's, for those of you who've been around for a while, the foreign source, the Department of Finance economists have thought that the foreign source income provisions were part of the explanation for the unusual pattern of corporate revenues, and they haven't really ever successfully sorted that out. But I think the main explanation is just the volatility of corporate profits and the high reliance on them. It is interesting, though, that you point out that this notion that really it's a tax on sort of property, payroll, and sales, because economists would say that in many ways that's right, because you're basically taking national income and allocating it to the state, and when you do the algebra, when you really figure it out, it really does sort of work out to be just the in-state part of the tax really is sort of like a tax on sales, property, and payroll, which means that as we go to more of a sales more method of allocation, then the tax becomes more like a sales tax that's paid at the corporate level. But of course, the key thing as to the liability for the tax, it depends upon being a C corporation and having profits. If you don't qualify under either of those two rules, you don't pay the tax. And so you can imagine, as more businesses that are not publicly held, you know, companies that are traded on the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ or something like that, as more of those kinds of companies become LLCs/partnerships, our tax base gets eroded, and that also lends to the volatility. And it raises a policy question about why should we have a business tax that only applies to large multinational companies that want to have access to the securities markets in order to raise capital. What's the sort of policy basis for this tax, which is sort of a longer, interesting discussion.
Mr. Michael, if you're moving on from Representative Liebling, Representative Dela Forest has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question. In discussing the volatility of the C-Corps and others, I'm wondering if there is a breakout that tracks the volatility of the tax regarding flow-through type businesses like partnerships or S-Corps or other small businesses. Do you know, Mr. Michael, do they experience the same volatility? Do you have a breakout for that?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Vito Forrest, that would be an interesting thing to look at. I have not looked at the sort of the revenues that we collect under the individual income tax from business income. That would be an interesting thing to plot that compared with the corporate franchise tax revenues. My instinct, and this is nothing more than intuition and instinct, is that those revenue flows are not as volatile as the you know, the sort of the publicly held C corporations experience. But
Representative Dilafort.
Purely an instinct.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just follow up with a comment. It would be interesting. I don't know if that would tax the resources too much of our folks, but it would be interesting to see because, I would just disagree with Mr. Michael in one sense intuitively. But a lot of small businesses, as opposed to major multinationals, they generally maybe have only one or two customers, and so their revenue levels, Representative Liebling, so much aren't dependent upon the economy so much as if you've got a major client of yours or customer that experiences problems for whatever reason, you can have serious revenue issues based on nothing that have to do with the economy. So I would think intuitively some of these smaller businesses would experience greater volatility, I would think, but I don't know. That's just a thought. It'd be interesting to see if we had the resources to check that out.
Thank you for that. Representative Carlson.
Just a quick question on the volatility. I have heard that acquisitions play a role in that volatility. Is that accurate? And in what way does that happen?
Mr. Mike.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, yes, the dynamic that is in play here is that essentially there is a federal law differs a little bit from Minnesota law, and all of this relates to whether you can carry losses back or forward. In Minnesota, we, and most states, do not allow carry back. So let's say you had a couple of profitable years where you paid tax, then you have a year where you're losing money for several, one or more years. Under federal law, that company can go and file an amended return for those previous years and carry back their current losses. Now, obviously, that's going to make revenue flows even more volatile because in a downturn, companies will start filing. They'll take carrybacks and they'll get refunds for the tax they paid in the prior years. We had a rule like that in the late 70s or early 80s, repealed it during one of the budget crises. But now to get to your point, there is a carry forward of up to, I think, 15 years. And so obviously if you've got a lot of losses, take a company like the Northwest Airlines, to use one that we're probably all fairly familiar with, that's operated, you know, in an unprofitable situation for years. Now they're in bankruptcy, so this wouldn't be a relevant thing. But a company like that that has 4, 5, 6, 7 years of losses and they have a lot of carry forward losses, there's a tax benefit that's associated with that carry forward loss that they're unlikely to be able to use and in fact may waste. If it goes on for a period of time, the ability to claim those may expire. And this is where Representative Carlson's point comes in. If they merge with or are acquired by another company that's very profitable, a General Electric or a Microsoft or somebody like that, suddenly they're able to use those carry-forward losses to reduce the tax that otherwise would have been owed by the company that acquired them. And so there's sort of a tax incentive for those kinds of acquisitions because there's, you know, sort of a benefit to it. On the other hand, if you're, you know, spinning off a company or getting rid of a company, then there's oftentimes a lot of planning that has to be done to avoid a potential capital gain that would result from that, that would result in a fairly big hit to the company that's spinning it off. So if it's an acquisition that involves spinning off and selling to another company, that works the other way. As I indicated, in 2005, the legislature, as many states have done, is decided to go not from a three-factor formula method of apportioning corporate income to a single factor based on sales. This is done in a very deliberate, slow fashion over 8 years. The slide shows how that pays in works. I think you can expect, I know the governor in 2006 and a portion of the business community has proposed accelerating how fast this phase-in occurs. The primary rationale for single sales apportionment is that it gives an advantage to in-state companies that sell many of their goods and services out of state. So it's viewed as sort of an economic development measure to encourage businesses to locate plant and equipment and employees in the state, because those, getting back to Representative Liebling's point, if you think about this tax for companies that have profits as sort of three taxes, one a tax on sales, another a tax on property, and another one on payroll, by eliminating the tax on property and payroll, you would presumably create an incentive for companies to have more property and payroll, and sales are calculated on a destination basis. So to the extent that you're making your sales outside Minnesota, there's no tax at all on those kinds of sales. So that's the sort of rationale or thinking behind going to single sales apportionment. Moving ahead quickly, I'll see if I can whip through the rest of the taxes. The gas tax, tax base is per gallon motor fuels, 20 cents rate. This is a per unit tax, not a price tax, so it's not sensitive to changes in the price of gasoline. And in fact, when gasoline goes up and consumption goes down, revenues go down. As you're all aware, the Constitution requires these monies to go to the Highway User Trust Fund, and local governments, as was presented to the Property Tax Division the other day, share in this and use it for city and county roads as well. The revenues from this tax are projected to be $651 million in 2007, and the revenues are generally pretty flat over time.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then, Mr. Michael, do you recall the discussion when, I think it's, is it a 5,000, the city has to be 5,000 to share in those revenues. Do you recall the discussion and why 5,000 was chosen? Was it just kind of a easy number?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, that's, that is even before my time. And so I do not know why why 5,000 was selected as the benchmark for the for a significantly sized city to get municipal state aid under the highway funds.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then, Mr. Michael, it hasn't changed. It's always been 5,000.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, as far as I can remember, okay. It's been 5,000. I don't, you know, we could go back and find out when that was put in place.
Six.
The next, and these taxes that I have listed are based on the order of magnitude of their revenues. So the next largest tax revenue source is the motor vehicle license tax or the tab fees. Here the basic tax base is the value of the passenger vehicle, and this is the value that's set by the manufacturer, and there are sort of complicated rules as to how options are calculated in that and so forth. Tax rates 1.25% of this base value, but really it's only in the first year of ownership that that full tax rate is paid. And then to further on the base, there's a depreciation schedule that's set in the statute that determines how that manufacturer's price depreciates over time. But more importantly, and this relates to Governor Ventura's limit on this tax, which was part of the famous or infamous, depending upon how you view it, the one-third, one-third, one-third deal in the year 2000. The tax is capped at $189 in the second year and $99 in the third year. And in no case is it less than $35. And there's also that $35 for someone who has a vehicle that's 11 years old or older, there's also some filing fees and other charges that causes the minimum to be over $40. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but you know, constituents ask you about it, that's why it's higher than that.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, Mr. Michaels, do you have any data about the progressivity or regressivity of this particular tax?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, let me see if I can quickly spot in the incident study whether they're what the motor vehicle registration tax is, has a suit index of a negative 0.1, which is slightly more progressive than less, I should say, it's better to say less regressive than the basic sales tax. It's about 30% less regressive than the sales tax. So of the consumption taxes, this is a little bit less regressive than the other ones.
Mr. Michael.
And it's certainly less regressive than the gas tax. As you would.
Mr. Michael, following up with Representative Liebling's question, prior to Governor Ventura's change, however, it was significantly more progressive than it is now, was it not? Can you give us a little history on the change, kind of where it was before that? And I know Representative Earhart just left. It's really the transportation gurus who really follow this stuff, but he's still here. Mr. Michael, was it more progressive and it became more regressive after the Governor Ventura change, or maybe I'm not remembering that correctly?
Madam Chair, I think that's probably a fair characterization of the impact of the change, because as one would expect, purchasing a more valuable car is probably positively related to your income. And so when you cap that tax at a flat amount of $189 or later $99, that's going to reduce disproportionately taxes paid by higher income households. So I think it's probably a fair characterization that change made the tax slightly more regressive than it otherwise would have been. Cigarette and tobacco tax.
Mr. Michael, I'm sorry. I'm just going to stop here. I think members are going to have questions on this tax, and I know you're trying to hurry and get through it all, but we're just not going to be able to make it. So, members, we're going to adjourn. Remember, we meet tomorrow for 1 hour, and we'll stop at 11 to make it over to State of the State. Thank you, members. Meeting adjourned.